This is Craft Council from the Craft Council. Conversations with makers about their craft, their challenges, and the ideas that shape their future. For more information, find us via the Craft Council website, www.craftscouncil.org.uk, or on Instagram at Craft Council.
Hello and welcome to Crafts Council from Crafts Council. I'm Anna Fielding.
And I'm Lewis Dalton Gilbert.
And today, our very first guest we have with us is artist and designer John Booth. John's work spans ceramics, illustration and a whole lot more. And he's appeared in, well, a whole load of places actually, isn't it, John? He's half of Supergroup with Ian McIntyre. And they've just produced a collection of objects for the Conran shop. He's also worked with Birkenstock, produced a range of tableware with Hem, worked for the Rosewood Hotel. I mean, you've been in shop windows and galleries and all sorts of places, haven't you?
Yeah.
But to kick us off, we wanted to kind of find out where the magic happens. So could you tell us about your studio workspace and kind of what you can see while you're working and what do you value about it?
My studio is, and it has been, in an arch in Haggerston for quite a lot of years. And I think I remember you visited quite a while ago.
I've had the privilege.
It's quite a long time. I've been there for 10 years. So I share it with a few people, including Ian McIntyre, and there's a few other people in there. People have come and gone over the years, but I've been there for 10. It's a pretty damp railway arch in Haggerston. We've got three kilns at the back of it. So there's people doing, primarily everybody in there is doing ceramics, and I do my ceramic work in there, but I also do my non-ceramic work in there. I don't know, it's one of them things, it's like I'm almost in denial about how long I've been there. I almost deny how much it's my every day, like at least 5 days a week I'm there, but it's kind of like I'm almost in denial about it being like a pretty regular workspace in a way. But it's been the one constant, because I think even in the past 10 years I've moved around quite a lot, but I've now settled in New Cross, so I quite like my journey up to Haggerston. Really just sort of rough workshop, a bit damp in the winter, a bit cold, but in the summer it's really amazing. It's like we've got double doors that open up, it's really nice to hang out in there. It's almost like the nearest thing you could have to art school in a way, in that it's like you can do what you want in there. It's a non-pressure space, but really good place to make my work.
Yeah. Do you like having those sort of regular hours, almost like business hours?
Yeah, I think I need it. Because if I didn't, I think when you work for yourself, it's so unstructured. I think I'm definitely one of the types of people I benefit from having a sort of a relatively strict, you know, try and get in for 10-ish, leave at 6-ish. But often, a lot of variables.
Creative license.
There's a lot of variables. Don't usually work weekends. But again, not because I'm trying to be precious with my time, just because I don't want to work all the time. But it's funny, if I do find myself in there on a Saturday, it feels completely different to a weekday. So actually, I really like being in on a Saturday. I also definitely made the decision that I want to share a space with people. So that's part of my day-to-day, is enjoying working around people. But even just because again, when you work for yourself, you haven't got a colleague, or I guess I work with Ian McIntyre a lot, but even then we're not always working together. So even when Ian's in, he'll be working on his own stuff and I'll be doing mine. But it's just quite nice to have them, like day-to-day people that you would have like tea and biscuits within the afternoon and stuff, you know, just, or like moan about things with. So it's really nice in that way.
Did you meet Ian in the studio?
Exactly that, yeah. So I've met, and Matt Raw, the ceramicist, he was in the studio when I started there, and he sort of sublets his space even though he lives in Paris, but he's another sort of work connection of mine and good friend of mine. So I like sharing with these people that have inspired my practice, but also definitely informed it really a lot.
We've talked about how your practice covers so many different things. How would you say that you got into your form of making? It's probably the best way of putting
it. I think about this quite a lot, because it kind of just happened over time. Because I think one thing I didn't do was I didn't stop doing stuff. So it kind of just happened. And I think one of the pivotal things was doing ceramics. So I did that in 2015. I did an evening class in ceramics based off the desire of just wanting to work in that medium, and but also having a new sort of medium to decorate and to work with, because I think I'm ultimately interested in surface decoration and pattern, because my background was I studied fashion with print at Central St Martin's. So I was in the fashion department, but it was very much with a view to sort of working with fabrics and embellishing it or embroidering it or printing it. So it wasn't even just screen printing, it was actually everything around that as well.
What is it you think that attracts you to that kind of surface decoration? Where's the love for print coming from?
That's a good question. I think I've always been into it. I think I just, I like colour and pattern. I can trace it back to even being a kid and liking clothing then. Because I've got a twin sister as well. I was always in quite close proximity to more quintessential sort of feminine clothing. And I would always want to, we would share clothes. Like I wanted to, we weren't brought up to sort of be definitively sort of masculine or feminine in that way. So I think, but even then, well, she's not really into pattern and colour, but I am. So maybe always been into it, always enjoyed working with pattern and colour and kind of always been good. Well, I don't know if it was good at art school, but like into it.
I've got to say, for people who are listening and can't hear, John is wearing a shirt in the most glorious shade of pink with a little yellow logo
quite
on it.
Aggressively pink.
And you've got tattoos all over you, a bit of your own surface design on your arm.
Yeah, there is, exactly. No, it's just, I think it is, I do think about this quite a lot without romanticising it, but yeah, always been into pattern and drawing and, I don't know, especially even collaging. As a kid, like my mates would be outside, but I'd be inside. I was into decoupage. You know, like sort of collaging and like making, like, which I definitely got bullied for by my older siblings. I've got an older brother. Maybe not bullied, but it was just maybe a bit frowned upon. It was always for enjoyment. And kind of, even as a kid, getting a new set of felt tip pens at Christmas and just being quite excited about that. So it's kind of always been there.
Memorising all the shade names in the Crayola all box. That, you're like, yeah. It's periwinkle loved and it. I want it.
Love it.
You've spoken about the sort of enjoyment you get from craft, but what does it mean to you?
For me, it's like my day-to-day life. It actually, it's like I love doing it. I'm lucky enough to make a living from that, or sort of part of making a living from it. So it's kind of just, it's like really present in my life and something that I really love and do a lot, but try and, you know, in various forms, make a living from it, whether that's down to sort of designing ceramics for a company and taking a royalty from it, or designing, you know, prints that go onto fabric. So I've actually enjoyed the challenge of trying to sort of find as many different applications for how I could work and make a living from that.
Was it hard making a living from your craft? Or is that something that was always a goal for you?
It is hard, definitely. Because I think, so I graduated in 2009, and it definitely didn't happen straight away. There was definitely years where I was, to make a living, I was doing lots of different things. And actually, one of my main sources of income for quite a long time was teaching. I sometimes forget to speak about the fact that I did teaching. I actually really enjoyed that. And I still do it a little bit, but for about 6 or 7 years after graduating, that was one of my main points of income. So I was teaching fashion drawing at Central St Martin's and also doing sort of design lecturing there as well, and a little bit at Westminster Uni in the fashion department.
I can see you being a good teacher, actually. You're a good explainer of things.
Thanks. It's a nice compliment. That I think there's something in me that I really enjoy teaching. I'm almost a bit sad to do less of it, but it's not because that actually wasn't even a choice. I think I just got offered. A lot of universities now just want tutors to be permanent members of staff, so it's harder to be a lecturer to just dip in and out of it. But actually, I miss it. But I did some teaching recently on the textiles course at Chelsea, and I really loved it. Really loved that. We were doing sort of mark making, and doing that just takes you back 20 years to when you did it for the first time. And I was like, I love this. It's quite rejuvenating doing it with, and you're just showing people such simple things. But when you see people approaching it in a new way or for the first time, it's actually really, that's quite a wholesome feeling where you're like, oh, that's quite satisfying.
And you've spoken a bit about the other artists that you share your studio with, but I was wondering if there were any other artists and makers from all time who you really admire and count as influences.
There is. So the teacher in me sort of also made a little list that I've got in front of me here just to refer to.
Love to see it, John.
Yeah, but even when I was teaching, one of the things I enjoyed doing was that if I was speaking to a student about their work, but I'd want to give them as many references or like artists to look at. That was my personal challenge that I really liked doing. But when it's for yourself, I was like, I have to write myself a bit of a list. But I guess thinking about this, I was just thinking, I'm always really drawn to fabrics. So people that have done amazing stuff with fabrics and even I love pattern. I never get tired of looking at patchwork things. So first on my list was Adam Pogue, a guy, I don't know if you've seen his work. I think he's based in America. He does these really beautiful sort of, their patchwork pieces. Like there's like sort of wall hangings or cushions, but he does them by hand. And they're just really beautiful mixtures of fabrics. I was really into that.
And that's Adam Pogue, as in Shane McGowan and the Pogues.
Exactly,
that's the spelling.
Him, yes, yeah.
Okay, yeah. Not that he was in the Pogues, just the spelling.
Yeah, love his stuff. Also, I recently saw last year at the Lucian Day, so those silk sort of mosaics, which again got me going. I think when I think of references that I like, they often are, it's patchwork stuff. I don't think I've ever met a patchwork thing that I don't like. There's always something in that I'm into, but they were really amazing. I also like that sort of silk, shiny silk dupion that they were made from, just tiny little squares. And it's funny because I would say my work is much more loose than that, but I think I admire the sort of how intricate that they are. I find that them very intricate. So I almost admire that level of control or skill made to put those together. Really nice. G's Bend quilt makers, always love seeing that. And I've seen them referenced such a lot. But I just, again, I mean, there's a Craig Green collection a few years ago that definitely referenced that, which I loved.
Why then particularly of all the quilt makers that could be chosen?
It's just, I think there's something, because it's such a universal technique, isn't it, patchworking, but there's something I could spot. I think I could spot a G's Bend quilt quite quickly because it's just about, it's the... There's the way that they're structured, but it's the mixture of colours. Mm. I think I could spot it. But I know they could be easily emulated, but actually, I don't know, maybe they couldn't. I just think it's distinctive in its looseness, which is quite hard.
What makes the quilts from G's Bend so distinctive is that they all come out of this small, isolated community in rural Alabama, where black women have passed down this tradition since the time of slavery by turning scraps of fabric into bold improvisational designs and asymmetrical patterns that carry history, resilience and creativity. So they're often less uniform.
Totally, totally. But I've even got, back to my childhood, I've even got really fond memories of my mum trying to, because my mum is actually really crafty as well, which is probably quite a big influence. But she went through a phase of wanting to make patchworked quilts, but she had me sit and cut out sort of templates from like cereal boxes, but cutting out hundreds of hexagons. You know where they'd be stitched? You'd stitch them together with the cereal box in, well, the cardboard. She was doing it by hand and it was just like, I think she gave up quite quickly, but I do remember there's definitely a few weeks of me cutting out hexagons a lot. But back to G's Bend, I do think you can, yeah, they're distinctive, aren't they, which I really like.
Any more?
Back to my list.
Yeah, go, come on, I'm loving your list.
Yeah, do you know what? And actually, crossovers, this is another one that came to mind, another sort of fabric application was Dovecot Studios in Edinburgh. So when they do the amazing tapestries, because I've seen them working with various artists to translate maybe a painting and then do it into a tapestry. So there's an artist in America that, like Matt Connors, a sort of abstract painter. But one of my favourite things was when Matt got them to do version of one of his paintings in tapestry. And it looked even better than the painting in a way. I just loved it. They captured every sort of every part of it. And again, thinking about tapestry, have you seen the Eva Rothschild tapestries in the hallway of the new... The new Sadler's Wells East. That was
amazing. They look wonderful.
They really do. I think it's also just the, you know, with the different fabrics, like thinking of the Lucian Day, the sort of shiny silk, but then also the matte threads that you see in often in those sort of tapestries. I really like the matte but dense coloration you get on a tapestry.
Is it something you'd ever fancy doing, kind of quilting or tapestry?
I would love to. I'd really love that. I did a tiny little thing for Liberty last year. They were celebrating their, I can't remember, like 160th birthday or something. And they asked lots of different designers and artists to do a patchwork square. So they let me look through their archive and choose lots of different fabrics. And I did a tiny little patchwork thing. It was quite structured as well. And I was like, it had arrows that were patchworked together and it had 3D arrows coming off of it. But from that, I came across a design I particularly liked. And it turns out it was I can never say her name. Is it Althea McNeish?
Yes.
Althea, yeah. So I found there was one print that Liberty did ages ago, back in the 50s or 60s, and it was called Port of Spain, where she was from. It was such an amazing print. And I looked into who designed it, and it was her. And then I just sort of realised that last year as well, the year before, Grace Wills Bonner used one of her prints on an anorak. So I kind of, again, it was like looking back at fabric stuff that really got me going. And then from that, I found a Designers Guild fabric that Howard Hodgkin did for them in the 80s of the giant tulips. And it was the only fabric that he ever did. It came in two different colorways. And then I just, so I bought, so I found some of that on eBay. But I just, it just, I don't know, the past year or so, I've definitely thought about how much I'm really into fabric still. Kind of looking at that.
We should put this out as an advert then, John. If there's anyone...
Anybody yet?
I mean, sort of just to follow on from that, you've spoken about a couple of those have been about you getting to go through some archives. Is it one of the kind of joys of being someone in your position that you get access to these things, these spaces, these archives?
It's massively lucky to do that because that's, you kind of got to be... I don't know, it's, I guess you kind of got to be in a situation where you can do that or you're invited to do that or you're... A recent example of that would be I'm working with Royal Copenhagen in Denmark, the sort of...
Like, very, very fancy china.
Very that, exactly. and speaking of archives, so I'm doing a little collection of objects and things with them that's coming out next year. But one of the nicest things I got to do was look through their archives. So they were just opening up drawers of things that are 200 years old or little mouldings or castings of objects or handles or teapot lids. And it was just like, that was amazing. So yeah, archival stuff is, but I think it's, I'm really lucky I get to do that as part of my job, but even if it's even just part of my own interest, I want to keep learning about stuff. But often it's useful if you're prompted into that, I think. So even Liberty sending me some fabrics made me find out a lot about one particular designer who's actually amazing.
This might be hard for you to answer because your practice spans so many disciplines. But what tool couldn't you live without?
The first thing that comes to my head is it would be scissors and glue. Like, because I'm constantly, like, back to my decoupage days, constantly cutting out paper and sticking it back down. So, and that's part of a huge part of my design process. Because I guess no matter what I'm working on, it usually it stems from a drawing. So even if I'm doing... It always stems from a drawing, always. Yeah, and often that drawing would be collaged. I can't imagine doing any design or any drawing that isn't collaged. And I think it just gives you that... I love cutting something up because it gives you that sort of... I don't know, you can just start again or cut it up and rearrange it or improve it or cut it up and remove it altogether. So I think for me it would be... It's scissors. Cut it up.
Yeah, that stick it sense. Down. That makes sense, and also... Especially talking about how inspired you are by like patchwork and stuff. That a lot of that is cut and paste.
Totally.
Things together. And
you're
like,
right.
Using detritus.
Yeah, precisely. No, I think that's true. That is. Maybe there is. Yeah, I guess that totally makes sense. I think even just from speaking to you, I'm sort of working this through. I like things that are patched together, whether it's drawings or paintings or fabric. But it is part of my, and even again, back to teaching, it was. It's quite, in a mean way, it's quite liberating making a student, if they're very uptight or they've done a drawing, I'm like, now you need to cut it up. And you can tell that it makes them uncomfortable, but it's freeing to cut something up, I think, or to not be too precious about it. That was quite drummed into me at St. Martin's.
That was always really hard for me when I was studying fine art, because I'm such a perfectionist, I find it really difficult. But it's really important to get messy, I think, you know.
Agreed, totally, totally. But yeah, cutting it up. And then putting it back together. Because actually, collaging is, I mean, you can do amazing stuff with that. And the end result could be quite refined or quite sort of sparing. It doesn't have to be heavy. But yeah, so maybe that's a link that I've sort of just thought about, really.
I actually have a question for both of you, because my background's in journalism and writing and words, whereas you're the fine art guys. Do you have the kind of the same, are you taught in the same way, not just about cutting it up, but the phrase people always give to writers is kill your darlings? Like, if you love it too much, then it has to go.
For me, I don't know, when I was studying fine art at Chelsea, I think it was very concept-led, you know. And I think anything sort of went, and there was always this push to kind of explore other mediums. And I don't know if it was similar for you to Chelsea, but I mean, St. Martin's. But that was something I really struggled with, because I would always set out with a strong idea of what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So then when someone was challenging me to do it differently, I did struggle with it. But when I did it, it did really help me to kind of explore different ways to kind of communicate.
Yeah. I think having taught as well, I think tutors almost do it because it's a bit of fun. Like, I think they almost want to make you uncomfortable in a way. And I think it does do that. Yeah, it was drummed into me. Also, it was very much drummed into me at St. Martin's to work quite fast. So when you're drawing, it was just being loose with it. But I think I'd never really had that before. And then I think I took to that quite well, but because it really stuck with me. And it was just about not being too precious and just making work and being quite fluid with it and coming back to it, maybe doing a composition or doing a print design or, you know, even a garment design. And then doing that in 5 minutes and then doing another 10 in the next hour. That is one thing that I took from art school that I still apply to my sort of current work practice. I would do multiples of ideas. If companies want ideas, sometimes I've got to be careful to not send too many. I'm probably giving my secrets away, but almost I don't want to sometimes show companies how fast I work, because then I don't want them to, I don't know, to then be like, oh, well, we'll just take all 20 of those designs. I think part of my process would be working quite quickly and then self-editing or working back into it. But again, yeah, that was very, very much sort of passed down to me at art school.
I mean, the edits, yeah, it's so important.
Yeah. And the hardest part, I think.
What obstacles would you say you find at the moment?
Well, at the moment or just in general? I mean,
in general. Or at the moment?
I wonder. Lots of things. I think, obviously, since COVID, things have changed a lot with companies' budgets, so and people commissioning work and amount of work, or maybe in the past there would have been a bit more money on one specific design project, but now I think on design related projects the budgets are smaller, so I have to do a lot more design projects like that, but they still almost want the same amount of work for a much smaller fee, so I guess I'm kind of battling with that a lot, and that's fine. But it's just, I mean, that's always been the battle, was it's kind of, like I said, making a living from this and having enough work to make a living. But then that's why I end up balancing multiple projects at one time. But having said that, I think I like working like that.
I was wondering, and I think it's mostly because I've spoken to you around this topic when I've met you before, how you feel that social class plays into that kind of security or the ability to keep on going. Definitely. I mean, you're obviously quite established now, but, you know, for younger people.
Yeah, that took a long time. I guess that's another thing that I find quite satisfying when I teach, is actually explaining to younger people, actually, you're not going to have success overnight. It takes years, and it's never really... And for me, there's never a point where I can be like, oh, I don't need to do much now, because actually I still live month to month, really, or, you know, job to job. It's so ongoing and it can be quite relentless. So you constantly need to make sure that I need to make sure I've constantly got work to survive. But I think now it could be even more tough, because I think the cost of living is so expensive now. And like we said, post-pandemic and just in the modern world, it just feels a bit tighter with money. And it's just quite a heady mix of potential issues that I think people would be faced with. But for me, and it was quite drummed into me as well to be quite resilient and quite, I think I probably learnt a bit of a toughness at St. Martin's in that era, because I was there in the early noughties. It was just like, if you want this to happen, you have to keep doing it. So in answer to your question, I think it's about, the same problems have always existed, but they might be slightly more tense now due to, I guess, money, which is annoying, isn't it? But kind of inevitable, but feels maybe more pertinent than ever in a way. But I still think it's this, but there is still opportunities out there. So it's not all doom and gloom. I just think it, if anything, it always made me press for it. I pushed for this harder and didn't stop. And also did a mixture of stuff, which I think has ended up serving me well. You know, I might have to teach 2 days a week, and then you do your design work around that. Then you do work at a weekend, and then you still have to hustle. I think sometimes people are still quite shocked when I say to them that I still hustle for work. I think people think I just get these endless flow of emails being like, oh, do you want this job or that? And I definitely don't. So I still have to pitch for projects and ideas, and still have to hustle for work.
That did surprise me. I know everybody does. I mean, we're all in a freelance capacity sitting in this studio booth. But
I don't get shy telling people. It's one of the things that I find it quite satisfying to like debug that a bit, where people think I'm just sat in my studio waiting for these things. But but don't get wrong. I still might get an email out of nowhere once or twice a year I'm like, oh, that's a really nice project. And that's a good opportunity. But often it's me still well, actually, it's quite a recent thing where I'm making decks, like a deck of visuals, which is quite, I've joined the modern world. So I just want to do is send all the images to my boyfriend and be like, can you make a deck? But we're just like, but, like, he's, yeah, sometimes he answers the phone. He's like, John Booth, tech support, which is a bit cheeky. But I think he likes it. I don't know if he does. But I like that. I don't want to stop pitching for stuff or like hustling for work because I think you have to. But I think it's just, but again, I guess we think about it, and you've always seen this. There's always been a mixture of people in the creative industry where people have come from a very comfortable, like, affluent background, and it's maybe allowed them a lot more time to take risks and to do unpaid internships and to be in a position where they don't have to earn money. But I wasn't in that position. But I think it's, I still stand by the fact it served me well. And I think if people are in that position, it's not a dead end that you can make that work. You just might have to do a few different jobs and do some jobs you don't want to do, but then you'll get some jobs that you do want to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really important to dispel those myths and totally. To tell people that, you know, you still have to pitch and you're still going Absolutely. Out there and doing things.
Totally.
I think you do get this sort of Instagram versus reality, yep. don't you? Where yep. people assume that it's you're on an easy street.
Yeah. No, it's refreshing to sort of talk about that. Because that's why it's good to do things like this. I want to sort of speak about that because that is my background as well. I'm from like a very working class background. I guess one thing that's I was quite lucky in that, like, when I started studying, the tuition fees were $1,200 a year, but now I know they're insane. So that's a bit that it just makes me sad because it's like the money, the financial pressure. If I was 19 now, that would be. It could be enough to put you off studying.
Yeah.
So that's what makes me sad. Again, it's that thing of, because I'm still paying my student loan off. So I don't even look at the amount. I think it's so boring. I'll just, whatever I pay off every year, it's fine. But I know that it would be three times the amount now than what, or if not more, I'm sure a lot more.
Yeah.
So it's a bit.
But if you were going to go back to university to master another craft, what would that craft be and why?
I like that. I think I do think about this quite a lot. I applied for a master's after like 4 or 5 years after I finished my BA, and I didn't actually get on, and that, but maybe that gave me a bit of a kick in the right direction, because I think I thought I'll just breeze, because I'd already done some work in industry and I was doing my own thing. I thought I'll just breeze on to a master's at St Martin's, and I didn't. So that was quite a good, that definitely was a bit of a slap in the face, but a good one. Jewellery, I think about that quite a lot. So silversmithing, or like, I like jewellery.
Yeah.
And like, I think it could just be, I like looking at jewellery, even though I don't wear that much. I've got some earrings in, but I really like it as an art form, and I like that it's an intimate object, and it's crafted, and it's got this, so it can be as precious or not as precious as what materials you use. But I think jewellery would be something that I'm quite into. And I don't know, I still see, I guess it's sort of fashion related, but I do see that people buy into that, and I do see that there's a desire for that.
I could see that, John Booth, like, charm collection.
Yeah, I mean,
actually, that would rule.
Yeah.
Some of your designs as a charm bracelet, so I would love.
Yeah. I've had a few companies, again, maybe I'm just putting that out there. I've had a few companies.
Manifest it, John, manifest.
Speak it into existence.
Exactly. I've spoke to a few companies about it, and it never quite happened. But I just think I like jewellery as a thing, especially, you know, I like gold particularly. And I like it when it's not. There's a company in Paris called Healers Fine Jewellery, and they do really beautiful sort of hand-hammered pieces. I don't know if you've seen it. It's really nice. And they do they set stones into it, but it's all recycled gold. I don't even 100% know where it's recycled from, but it's really beautiful jewellery, quite refined, but not too perfect.
Mm.
And when I see that, I think I really love that. But maybe it's just, I don't know, is it just because I want to make stuff for myself? But maybe you'd need to sell it. I guess my commercial head being on, or just, you know, me thinking about having to make a living, jewellery could be tricky though, I guess, because it's higher price objects, but I wonder.
Maybe that could be your hobby. I think there's there's so much emphasis on things being, like, especially with craft, it being like a side hustle or something that you have to make money from. But I think there's so much enjoyment in craft. So
massively.
Maybe silversmithing can be your new hobby.
Yeah, I think I'm quite up for that. That would be really nice. And then, what's wrong with making stuff for yourself? Again, but that comes back to what we were saying before about the pressure of having to make money from the thing that you love doing can also quash it quite a lot. And I've seen it almost put people off it so much that they just leave their chosen field, especially in fashion. I've seen so many people that might have started their own fashion label and it's burnt out quite quickly, and then they don't do anything at all anymore like related to that. And that makes me quite sad. But I know that probably happens in a lot of industries. But yeah, that pressure to make money from something can be really a bit of a killer.
Do you feel like the teaching and the other jobs you had gave you that distance?
I think it did. It did. It definitely, it was, like I said, nice because you're actually helping people, but you're also reviewing and sort of renewing your own skills and knowledge. But also, yeah, it did. It took the pressure off having to, all my income to be from my own work. So that was actually pretty important in a way.
So we've got what is now my favourite question that we're going to ask you, which, if you were going to make anything, and we've spoken about money, but if time, money and physics was no object, what would you choose to make? What would be the John Booth grand piece?
Do you know what I really like? And actually, maybe it's not that grand when I think about it, but I've always wanted to do it. Would be like, you know, like a room divider, or like, what are they called? Or a screen like that. But imagine like a really like high-end version of that. So back to like having a tapestry, you know, or having a sort of a woven or a, you know, a tapestry screen done in my sort of pattern. That's sort of what I would, I think, could be really nice. But also imagine some really pretty intense jewellery. Or a sort of like stone encrusted thing, like a stone encrusted carabiner or something. I don't know. Things that, I mean, that it could, I could go on and on. I think, yeah, maybe a sort of tapestry would be good. Because that just feels like something that I couldn't replicate myself, but I would need, it's like one of those things that you would need to pay somebody to do. Or it could be quite expensive. But yeah, I think a room divider or a screen, but done really beautifully. Quite specific, isn't it? The thing is, if you ask me that next week, it might be something quite different. I guess it just depends on what you're looking at the time. I think it's just, I bought a Mark Camille Shamowitz book online recently, and I've seen that he did a lot of screens, and I was like, I really like them. Also, I haven't got room in my house for a screen, so maybe that's why it feels quite decadent, because there's no, I don't have a room that needs dividing. I need a room that needs
expanded.
Well,
I need some rooms that need to be made bigger. So for me, a screen feels quite opulent, quite a decadent thing.
So yeah, I've always wanted a screen.
Oh yeah, but you need
a space,
a screen worthy room.
Yeah,
or rooms
to quite chuck feather boas over and that kind of thing.
Very nice. I find them quite. They are. They're quite. There's something quite opulent about them.
Then our final question for you today is, do you have any advice for your fellow makers out there, or what's the best advice you've been given?
I feel like I went on a bit of a rant previously about advice, but I could sort of maybe condense it I would say it would be to carry on doing it, and you're fighting to sort of make it work, to make, you know, if you want to do what you're doing, you're going to have to find lots of different ways to be creatively satisfied, but also to hopefully make some money from it. But don't be afraid to sort of do a variety of things that you might, maybe at first you might not think it's good, but I do think, like I said, so not out of choice, but having to have had to do a multitude of different things to make a living from it, I think I've benefited from that creatively, but also it's been quite fulfilling. But also you learn a lot of different things whilst you're doing that. So I think too, you just have to sort of, and be quite tough with it. And I guess, I don't know if I've probably had good advice over the years, but I feel like my time, especially at St. Martin's, I was just made to be quite creatively sort of resilient and quite tough in a way, which again, it's easy for me to sort of pass on advice and make out as I'm like bulletproof, but I'm obviously behind the scenes, I'm very sensitive about stuff. Or if you get rejected by a client, or if you get bad feedback, it's still upsetting. But I think it's just about being quite resilient and sort of bouncing back from that.
John, thank you so much for coming and joining us today on what feels like the first day of spring.
Yeah, it's lovely. Thank you, and it's been great.
Thank you for listening to The Crafts Council from Crafts Council. Join us next time as we continue the conversation with 1882's Emily Johnson. Until then, take care.